we must identify the great benefits to the world which would come from a democratic China. There could be a great increase in prosperity. There could be a great renaissance of trust in the world. There could be China's contribution to art, science, as well as the economy and other aspects of human life could be so much greater and so much richer under a democratic regime.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Roger Garside, author and former diplomat in Beijing, shares his unique insight into China. Roger talks about senior Chinese Communist Party officials preparing for their own downfall.
More and more people in the senior ranks of the Communist Party of China recognize that their own regime, their own political system, having produced internal problems and these external problems, cannot deal with them.
He says the Chinese regime is scared of the Chinese people.
In the 75 years that the Communist Party have been in power, they've never allowed free elections. They haven't allowed freedom of expression. They haven't allowed freedom of religion. They haven't allowed freedom of assembly.
Today I'm sitting down with Roger Garside, author and former diplomat who served twice in the British Embassy in Beijing. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
In 2021, you published your book, China Coup, The Great Leap to Freedom.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a bit about the book and its main message?
With pleasure. The book really divides into two parts. There's three quarters of it which is non-fiction and one quarter which is semi-fiction. The three quarters which is non-fiction gives the reasons why I believe that the totalitarian dictatorship which now rules China is going to end in the next 3 to 5 years. The one quarter that is semi-fiction narrates one way in which that might happen. I chose three real life leaders of China and showed them leading a coup against Xi Jinping and launching a transition to democracy. That came out in 2021. Since then, all three leaders, the real-life figures I chose to I identified as most likely to lead a coup, have all been arrested, and one of them has died under suspicious circumstances in October last. So it's not, it's not going to happen in detail the way I've imagined and told, but it so much that has happened since the book was published does reinforce my conviction and produces more evidence of why this totalitarian dictatorship will end.
You talked about the three quarters of the book that discusses how China became ripe for this democratic revolution.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about how the nation got to that point?
Right. If we go back to 1976, when I was on my second tour in China, the country was trapped in deep poverty, stagnation. When Mao died, it was clear to people like Deng Xiaoping, who are more of a pragmatic frame of mind, that if the Communist Party was going to hold on to power, and they were determined above all else to hold on to power, then they were going to have to liberate the enterprise and energy of the Chinese people, which had been so evident in other places around Asia, and allow the people to acquire a level of prosperity. And only then would they tolerate the continuation of communist rule. So they embarked upon a certain transition towards the market, but no political change. The system of dictatorship, the Marxist-Leninist dictatorship, they were going to absolutely keep in place. And this, of course, was inherent with contradictions. And for three decades, it was successful in generating prosperity in China at a spectacular rate. But the inherent contradictions started to make themselves felt. And now we see the chickens coming home to roost. A whole array of problems, deep-seated, long-term problems, economic, political, moral, cultural, social, are manifesting themselves and are undermining the dictatorship.
I recently talked to Uyghur poet and academic Azizis Alkun, and he was talking about how Xi Jinping was bad news for the Uyghurs, and things got a lot worse when he took power, and how she's trying to get rid of all the non-Han Chinese, the Uyghurs, Tibetans, Mongolians, etc. Can you talk to a bit about, you know, according to your research, the role Xi Jinping plays, and has he stayed in power longer than you expected?
Well, what role did he play in the handling of these ethnic minorities? The ethnic minorities that you've named, like the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the Mongols, and others, have long-standing differences of identity with the Han, who make up the great majority of the Chinese people. These are differences of identity, of faith, of customs, practices, values. And Xi Jinping, being a totalitarian, cannot abide differences, people manifesting a different identity. And his answer to that problem is to double down on dictatorship. And that has worked at a certain superficial level, but many people in the Chinese Communist Party, senior officials, can see that it is only working at a superficial level, and that rarely it generates deep-seated and prolonged resentment.
You know, the biggest victims in all of this are obviously the Chinese people. Do you think the regime's afraid of the people?
Absolutely. Why do I say that? Well, a regime that trusted the people would allow free elections. In the 75 years that the Communist Party have been in power, they've never allowed free elections. They haven't allowed freedom of expression. They haven't allowed freedom of religion. They haven't allowed freedom of assembly. They have not allowed the transition from the command economy, which wasn't working manifestly, towards the market economy. They haven't allowed it to continue all the way. They stopped it halfway. Why? Not because it wasn't working. It was, but because it was creating a property-owning class that was wanted freedom, wanted democracy, wanted rule of law, and which was threatening the monopoly of power of the Communist Party.
So back in Mao Zedong's days, China was trying communism, and like everywhere that tried it, failed miserably.
Yes.
So they moved to this kind of capitalism, but a very corrupt slash authoritarian version.
Yes.
And you saw some of this move firsthand. Can you talk to us about how the move manifested?
Well, as I said earlier, the Chinese society, Chinese economy, was in stagnation and poverty when Mao died. And they had to do something about that, so they started the transition without political without political reform. And so there wasn't law, there wasn't proper regulation of the capitalist, the free market economy, which was growing up. And so corruption became widespread at every level and in every aspect of life, whether you were wanting to get your child into a better school or wanting a child to pass exams or get into the university, or whether you, if you wanted health care of a better quality, you had to grease the palm of somebody. And when Xi Jinping came to power, he launched the most vigorous and sustained campaign to supposedly stamp out corruption. But he only attacked the symptoms of corruption. He didn't attack the systemic causes of corruption. The systemic causes are the absence of the rule of law, the absence of an independent judiciary, the absence of free press to expose corruption, the absence of free elections in which corrupt politicians can be ejected and supposedly more honest ones can take their place, so on and so forth. These are the systemic risks and reasons why corruption existed and continues to exist. And the proof that his campaign has failed is that now, in the last 12 months, we've seen the purge of numerous top-level officials. We've seen the purge of the foreign minister after only being a few months in office. We've seen the purge of the defense minister, likewise a few months, weeks later. We've seen the purge of the whole of the top leadership of the nuclear weapons and missile command of the military. What this confirms in us is the belief that the campaign against corruption was only partly designed to deal with corruption. It was also politically targeted. It was a tool, a weapon for Xi Jinping to impose his personal authority on society, to root out people at officials at a lower level that he thought might be opposed to his strategies. So it wasn't purely an anti-corruption campaign, it was also a political purge.
Do you think it's fair to say that the CCP tried to move towards this form of capitalism, but they don't want to give out the freedoms that come with it, so it just can't work in the end, they can never quite reach it?
That's right, it can't work, because if capitalism is to work, it has to work within a framework of law and regulation. And although since Deng Xiaoping launched the strategy of reform and opening, they have built up a great body of laws, and they built up a big legal profession. There are courts, there are lawyers. But it's all subject to the will of the Communist Party and to the interests of the Communist Party. And so it isn't objective and independent, and it is susceptible to corruption, as I've described.
So you talked about the regime being outwardly strong but inwardly weak.
Yes.
Is that a reflection of these things?
I think these things are a very important part of it. But I mean, it looks strong, and in some ways it is strong, because the Communist Party is well organized and very ambitious and politically savvy, and it has used its power over 75 years to extract, and particularly over in the reform and opening era when the economy has been growing, it has used its power to extract wealth from the private sector, which was dynamic, which is dynamic and successful and innovative, and to use that wealth to build up the military and build up the high-tech internal security system, both of which work up to a point. So it looks strong, and in some ways it is strong, but it is weak because of the corruption, because of the alienation of large parts of the people. Religion in China today is practiced in some form or another by 350 million people, by the best estimates. Now, that's 350 million people out of 1.5, 1.3 million people who deny the ultimate sovereignty of the Communist Party, who say, hang on, there is a higher power than the Communist Party. The Communist Party is not the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong and good and evil. So quietly, without making a political fuss about it, many, many people, hundreds of millions of people, internally dissent. And that's a source of weakness. So that's, and the Communist Party knows that. Some of their own officials go to church or to the temple. And they have to fight against that. So the Communist Party knows this. And that's why they don't allow freedom. That's why they spend more of their budget every year on internal security than on external security. They're more afraid of the internal enemies than of the external enemies.
This is why they're so against freedom of belief, and you see various different religions get persecuted in China.
Yes.
Because people see a higher power than the Communist Party.
Yes.
So do you think the West, the Western governments, are doing enough to question the corruption, demand transparency from the Chinese regime?
Well, questioning and demanding fall on deaf ears where the Communist Party is concerned. We do a certain amount of it, and we must, and it's only right to stand up for human rights in our own societies, defend them at home, and promote them abroad. We haven't always taken that view, and in an earlier phase of British government, 10 years or so ago, our government was only too ready to soft pedal any protests about the absence of human rights in China, because they thought it was in our economic interests to do so. This was a totally false calculation, and thankfully, for the reasons that we discussed earlier, the scales have fallen from people's eyes. People's eyes have been opened, and a rather more realistic balance between supporting human rights and seeking economic gain has been adopted.
So we used to have the approach of the government was we would talk to China about human rights in private,
yes,
but not publicly.
Yes.
It seems we've luckily moved on from that period of time now.
Yes. I mean, the Chinese were laughing up their sleeves when we adopted that strategy. We could say what we liked to them behind closed doors. It made no difference to them. Thankfully, we have, as you say, moved on a bit from there.
We've recently seen some media reports about the Lord Mayor of London's links with Beijing.
Right.
Despite MI5 warning, the CCP poses a threat, etc.
Yes.
Would we understand this as naivety among some of Britain's political class, or are there other reasons?
I think there is naivety. I think there is greed. And there is ignorance. And there could even be corruption. as you say, people's eyes have been somewhat opened, and there's less of it now, I think. People are more on the outlook for it and ready to expose it. But I'm afraid that naivety, ignorance, greed are still there.
The pandemic probably did quite a lot to open people's eyes to the Chinese regime to some degree.
Yes.
Do you think people changed their minds quite a lot around that period of time? That's also when you brought your book out.
Yes, I do think people did change. I mean, when the epidemic started off in Wuhan, the Chinese regime tried to suppress it. The local officials tried to hide it to begin with. When it became impossible to hide it anymore, they had to face up to the central government, and the authorities had to swiftly begin to deal with it and use their extensive powers over their population to deal with it as they thought best. But even after the central authorities had been alerted to the reality of the pandemic in Wuhan, they were slow to acknowledge it internationally. They lent on the World Health Organization not to declare an international pandemic until the central authorities were ready for that. This all became apparent to our government and other governments. And it was a massive breakdown of trust at that point, an exposure of the duplicity of the communist regime. And then there was the refusal by that regime to allow an independent international investigation into the causes of the and origins of the pandemic, which is very, very serious, because we need to understand how this pandemic happened in order to guard against future pandemics. And I think the trust, both at government level and at popular level, many countries around the world, and you can see this reflected in result of polls taken by Pew Research, a great loss of respect and trust for the Communist Party. And that will not be restored until there is a change of political regime in China. And the same is true in our business dealings with them. The trust that has been destroyed, the mistrust that has been built, can only be restored through political revolution. And more people in the senior ranks of the Communist Party of China recognize that their own regime, their own political system, having produced internal problems and these external problems, cannot deal with them. And if they are to preserve their own wealth and power, and if they are to hold out any hope of saving China as a nation, then they know that there has got to be a profound change of political regime. There's got to be a political revolution. When I wrote the book, we published the book, people were astonished that I should say such a thing. But there are Chinese former officials of the communist system, professor from the Central Party School, who for 15 years taught political ideology to senior Chinese officials who were being groomed for the highest offices. She taught them for 15 years. She is now living in America, fellow of the Hoover Institution. She and others like her testify to the fact, as they see it, that a majority, 60, 70% of middle and upper officials of the Communist Party regard the political system that they have as broken and as inferior to constitutional government. Now, what exact kind of constitutional government China should have is an extremely important and open question. But they do believe that a systemic change is needed. We in the West, or in the liberal democracies like Japan, Korea, Taiwan, cannot dictate to China what kind of a system it should have to govern itself. But what we can and must do is to help those Chinese in China who want radical change to achieve it. And we have ways of doing that. But we must have that mindset which says this is possible. And we must identify the great benefits to the world which would come from a democratic China. There could be a great increase in prosperity. There could be a great renaissance of trust in the world. There could be China's contribution to art, science, as well as the economy and other aspects of human life could be so much greater and so much richer under a democratic regime. And you know, it's not just foreigners preaching this. If one reads carefully what has been published in China by economists about the economy, constitutional scholars about the need for constitutional government, et cetera, in field after field, there is evidence that thinking Chinese believe the sort of things I'm saying, and believe them more strongly than we do. They live with the problems. They know the problems more deeply than we can. And as they look around the world and ask themselves, what other systems are there? What are the systems that work better than the one we've got? There is only one real answer, and that is some form of elective democracy.
What can we do to help?
We can expose what is wrong in China. We can stand up for our own values. We can, and in standing up for them, we can do the sort of things that we are doing. Look at the American system of controls over export of high technology. This has been very effective. And you know, we in Europe and other liberal democracies have got to make sure that we play our part in this. So we have strength in our economy, strength in our science and technology, strength in our political system. Again, the Americans have taken the lead in using their great power in the world's international banking system to impose costs on Russia for the invasion of Ukraine. The Chinese know that we have that power, and we have shown our resolve to use it. And we may need to use it if Xi Jinping is tempted to use force or economic sanctions or whatever against Taiwan to try and impose mainland rule on China. We've got to show that we are ready to use the military, scientific, economic, and other muscle that we have.
You've been through quite a unique journey. You're a China watcher, literally, more than 50 years ago.
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about your story?
Oh, thank you. Well, I'll keep it short. It's 65 years now. 1958, I was a soldier doing my military service in Hong Kong. And I was sent with my troops up to the border to watch the to guard and observe the border. But this is 1958, and Mao had launched his Great Leap Forward, which became a great famine, and it led to the disease and death through starvation of 46 million people eventually, and great disruption, total disruption of economic and social life, a great leap into communism, abolition of all kinds of private property. So hundreds of thousands of mainlanders were trying to escape to Hong Kong over the land border. We couldn't absorb them all. So we had to turn many back. But I was there watching that on the border and wondering what the heck kind of regime is ruling this country doing these extraordinary things. So that opened my eyes and sparked my interest in China. After university, I joined the diplomatic service. I volunteered to learn Chinese. I spent 2 years in Hong Kong. During that time, Mao Zedong, who had lost quite a lot of authority and power because of the failure of his Great Leap Forward, was trying to regain it through the great cultural revolution, which he launched as I was busy studying the language. And that cultural revolution plunged China into anarchy and violence. I watched that day by day with my Chinese teachers in Hong Kong, reading the local newspapers, which were very good at monitoring what was going on across the border. And then I had my first diplomatic posting in Beijing, 1968 to 70, when the Cultural Revolution was still raging. It had moved from sort of the Red Guard era. They'd been sent off, tens of millions of them, into the countryside, out of the cities, into the countryside for 10, 15, 20 years. But there was still strife within schools, factories, workplaces, communities, and that strife went on, tearing workplaces apart, tearing families apart, until finally Mao agreed to use the army to restore order in China.
How many people were killed in the Cultural Revolution?
Yes, estimate of 2 million people. That's not a lot in China. It's a big figure, but it's not a lot in China. Worse than the physical deaths was this terrible undeclared civil war, which tore families and work places apart and destroyed Chinese culture. The Red Guards were sent out into the streets by Mao. Not only to beat up, torture, and kill people who held views with which he disapproved, but to smash beautiful objects or to desecrate sacred places. That was my experience of the Cultural Revolution, and I then went away for 6 years. I worked at the World Bank, and then I came back to China 6 years later, and Mao was still just alive. There was a stalemate and stagnation and poverty, as I say. He died, and within a month, the pragmatists in the leadership of the Communist Party arrested his closest allies, who became known as the Gang of Four. Gradually, over the next 2 years, the worst aspects of Mao's policies were abandoned by his chosen successor, Hua Guofeng. But Hua was weak, and he was displaced by Deng Xiaoping. Before I left China in January 79, Deng Xiaoping had emerged as a supreme leader of China and was announcing the sort of reform and opening. It was a very, and I knew I had a great story to tell. I'd witnessed over the preceding 3 years, I'd witnessed this great turning point in Chinese history. And so I took a year's unpaid leave, and I went away and wrote my first book, which was called Coming Alive, China After Mao, which was very well received, and in contrast to my second book, was widely reviewed by all the major papers and journals in the liberal democratic world. And so that was 79, 80, I was writing that book. I didn't return to China until I had retired from economic life. I went back in the early 2000s, by which, of course, there had been tremendous economic growth. And then in 2017, I went again because I wanted to update my impressions of China firsthand in order to write my second book, China Coup, The Great Leap to Freedom. And that was when my eyes were really opened to the reality that what we are looking at in China is not an authoritarian regime on the lines of Singapore, Indonesia under Suharto or something like that, but is a totalitarian regime. And so a good deal of my book, a whole chapter of my book, is devoted to explaining why this is a totalitarian, not an authoritarian regime, and explaining why religion and the 350 million who practice some kind of religion in China is really very important in China, and why the economy already, as I wrote it in 2019, was beset by deep-seated problems. And now I am fascinated to see how things will move forward in the coming years.
So what are your hopes finally? Obviously China is very important to you. Yes. What are your hopes over the next few years?
Well, my hope is that, well, my expectation is that the economic problems, which are receiving a lot of attention in the world's press now, most spectacularly the collapse of the property market in China, which was riddled with debt and corruption and falsehood, and has been for years, and friends of mine have been pointing it out for years. But the collapse of the property sector has destroyed the tax base of local governments in many parts of China. They were very dependent upon selling land to property developers. That was 40% of their revenues, and it's gone. And they've replaced it, to keep themselves afloat, they have replaced it with a series of Ponzi schemes, which are going to run out of road. Quite when, I can't predict. But I mean, it could be 3 years, could be 5 years. But when that happens, banks will collapse. More and more companies will collapse. Shadow banking, a very murky area in which people have invested a great deal of their money, will collapse. There will be widespread mass unemployment. There will be outrage. And when that happens, those Communist Party senior officials whom I've referred to earlier, who know that the only hope for them and for China is in political change, will seize the moment and the initiative and will give voice and mobilize the people to make a political revolution. That is what I am sure is going to happen. It's not a hope, it is a prediction. Beyond that, when that happens, then we can be hopeful that a better system of government will be built in China. Of course, there are great risks of chaos. There's a great risks of strong men coming to power, a Chinese Putin. But I believe that the dangers of not attempting a democratic revolution are greater than the dangers inherent in it. And it would take another book to say this, but I believe that the Chinese are better placed, actually, to launch a democratic revolution than the Russians were when they pulled apart the Soviet Union. So I am, on balance, optimistic.
Roger Garson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak my mind.